How do we snap out of this? This is...
I don't know.
We need to shift the energy.
Well, I'll shift the energy.
No, but we need to, like, I think we need to shift the energy before we get started. Can I have a sip of that water?
Sure.
That'd be annoying if I did that after every sip, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but maybe it gave some colour just doing it one time.
I had a friend who was married to a guy who would do that after every sip.
Oh, they're not married anymore.
They're not. She would tell me about little moments where she knew the marriage wasn't to be. And I think
that was one of them.
Yeah.
I dated someone once and I had to go. He had a friend who was like in some kind of avant-garde classical band. If you're playing classical music, can you be in a band?
Yeah, I guess it depends how many people there are. I think there's probably...
Maybe a quintet or something. Maybe he was in a quintet. That sounds right. And so we went to see this friend do this avant-garde thing.
Do you know what George Harrison would call avant-garde?
Oh, yes. You've told me this before, but now I can't remember it.
Avant-garde a clue, more like.
Yeah, that's funny. Did he make that up?
Sounds like something a Beatle might have said at a press conference.
I think it's very clever. Yeah. I don't think it's a dad joke. I think it's very funny.
It's fine. It's fine.
Anyway, so we were sat there, and then my then boyfriend at the end of it, and I mean, I was like going to put a gun to my head. It was so bad what I thought I was watching. I thought what I was watching was so bad. And then with no sense of humor about it, my then boyfriend, when the concert was over, went, "Bravo!" and I was like, there we go. And I sort of, like you do in a relationship, like, oh, are you being funny? And then he was real annoyed at the suggestion that I thought it was sort of ridiculous. And he was like, that's what you do if it's classical. And I was like, I just don't think this is a match. But this was a good energy shift. Well done.
Hello?
Welcome to Beetlejuice.
Hello?
With Jeff Lloyd.
What?
Because everything's better with the Beatles.
Yeah, it's just something a bit more, because it does sound a bit dead when you hear it just as an intro.
How about this, then?
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
This is Beetlejuice with Jeff Lloyd.
Yeah, we'll have it, we'll have it!
There's only one. It was worth it for that.
In our marriage, how much of the conversation is instigated by you, with me sort of responding and asking questions as a percentage?
You're obviously that you think I do all the instigating.
Yeah, I think it's 80-20.
We're mostly talking about stuff that I'm more interested in. That does sound right to me.
Yeah. What if I brought to our marriage conversationally, we shifted it more towards 50-50, even if it was 60-40, but I made up the shortfall by bringing up the kind of things in real life that I bring up on this podcast or the radio show to do with the Beatles.
Yeah.
Would that be uninteresting to you?
I think so, yeah.
The only way I can talk to you about this stuff and have it be interesting is in the context of the podcast.
Why, do you feel you've tried a couple things with me recently and I've really shut it down?
No, not at all. I've just been thinking about how much I'm enjoying talking to you about this stuff on the podcast.
You're not really.
No, I really am. And
you're thinking, how can I bring more of this into our marriage?
Or I was thinking...
When the podcast is done?
Kind of. I was thinking, is it just unrealistic that we could have these conversations with any degree of regularity outside of a podcast and then be all interesting to you? Or is it just the artifice of having microphones in front of us that makes you engage with them?
Oh, God. I feel really, really bad, but I don't think... Like a thing that would feel, I'd be very up to watch that Beatles Education, whatever those things were.
Anthology.
The anthology. I'd be very up for rewatching that. That could engage me. I love that George Harrison documentary. But it's because I have nothing to contribute, because thinking about them isn't interesting, it's never something I would just do if it weren't for this podcast. It's like there's a work element involved in it for me. But I would love, like, it's like you have a best friend who's super into the Beatles. So,
well, I haven't spoken to Chris for a couple of weeks, but I feel like with some of these conversations I've been having, Chris knows
having
his stuff.
Those conversations with those bloggers is like you've been lying on the mattress injecting heroin into
yes.
your veins.
Yes.
And So, but I still don't understand why Chris wouldn't be more satisfying than me.
You don't think he's going to think, he's gone out of control. He's gone, there is he's gone down the rabbit hole.
There is something about it that feels out of control, I think. I was thinking about that because you said in your radio show at one point, hold on, let me bring up my list. You said that you spend a weird amount of time referencing their relationship to chocolate. And what that meant, as someone outside looking in, is you lost a day.
Yeah.
You lost a, there was a, just an additional full day of work where you were sort of largely MIA because you were looking up their relationship to chocolate. And it's very hard to understand, like, if that's lovely because you're having a nice time, or if it's not great because you're part of a, you're, you know, a member in a family unit. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. I can't figure it out. I can't figure out if what's going on with me in this radio show is just because I've not got that much else on at the moment. So I'm letting it... I basically used to do this same radio show for years, as you know. And it took me an hour or two to put the music together, about an hour to scribble some facts down, and about an hour or two to record it and put it all together.
And it was a great show. And it was well reviewed. It wasn't like this dog shit thing where you thought, God, you know what one of my regrets is? That Beatles show could have been great. And if only I'd gotten another shot. It was a very good show that was very well received.
And I think to the casual listener, the two shows wouldn't really sound that different. But something is going on with the show where I'm spending a week
on it. And we have a child.
But I'm not absent from our child's life.
No, you're not absent from a child's life, but the sort of evenings are now gone. Because instead of us sitting down on the sofa to watch something at 8 o'clock at night, you work on this show approximately from 8 o'clock to midnight for what, 3 or 4 nights a week? I don't know if I just feel like it doesn't feel good because I don't have control over it.
Because it's this subject that obsesses me.
You're not in control.
Yeah, it's like, I'll tell you what it's like. It's like the difference between being a diver who goes down and dives for pearls and brings them back up to the surface versus that fella in that documentary, My Octopus Teacher, who ends up sort of living underwater and becomes obsessed with the octopus.
Yeah.
It's something that's what's happening. It's very particular, I think, to this time where I feel like I've got the time to spend on it. But I haven't, because it's impacting on our marriage.
Yeah, yeah. This doesn't feel
healthy.
It does. It absolutely feels unhealthy.
Well, I'll think about everything you said. Do you know the one takeout I think I'll remember from that conversation?
Yeah, go on.
That you will watch the anthology with me again.
I will do that.
Because I've sometimes thought that the only way I would get you to watch that anthology with me again is if I was diagnosed as having a very finite amount of time to live. And I'd say, I'd like to do this again before I die.
Oh, yeah, I would do that. But I would be like, that feels much more manageable to me than this, or the idea of like working it into our marriage is one of the things we talk about. It's viewing something doesn't ask anything of me.
We'd have to leave it. What this thing needs to be behind us. You'll need a Beatles detox after this.
I need a Beatles detox. Yeah, I really. I'm so selfish, I guess. Okay, so it's Easter Monday as we record this. What do you think was going on with John Lennon and chocolate? On a scale of 1 to 10, how dysfunctional do you think John Lennon's relationship was to food?
It's a good question.
Just give me a number, and then you can get into it.
I think by the end of his life, probably like an 8. You've actually helped me think differently about that. So I knew there was that thing about John feeling like the fat beetle around Help.
Right.
Him having body... Because he said that. Like some newspapers started calling him the fat beetle, and then he had issues around it. And then I know he got very thin, but I didn't put the two together. And then I got some years ago this Hunter Davis book, which is collections of letters that John Lennon sent. Some of them were to fans, some of them to family members. Some of them were just shopping lists for his personal assistants. And you took one look at one of these shopping lists and said, oh, that's someone with an eating disorder.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know that.
Oh, I educated you?
Well, yeah, because I don't know what a somebody with an eating disorder shopping list looks like. And you were convinced just by looking at the food that John had sent his assistant out to get that he had an unhealthy relationship. And then as I then look at pictures of him through the 70s, I think this isn't just a guy who was obsessed with macrobiotic diets because of health.
No one is ever obsessed with that stuff because of health, is what I think.
Never.
Not singly.
You think it's always about what your body looks like?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's, if you said to anyone who talks about food, who hangs their food obsession on health, and you said, I got to tell you something about this macrobiotic thing you're doing. You're gonna gain weight. They would never do it. Weight loss and thinness is always involved every time.
So it's never just hypochondria?
No, I don't think so.
Or wanted to live a long time?
No, I think anyone like, I think there are people who aren't vain. I think there, you know, you can be not vain and be into it. But I think the thinness is always this reward for that people, for those people.
But eating disorders aren't vain, are they? It's, what's at the root of them? They're sad.
But when I think about the people that I know who are very neurotic about their bodies, it's a mix of, like, in that group, and for me, it's mostly women jump to mind. There are people who would, like, are incapable of going out in the morning without full makeup on. And then other ones who, it's just, it's not about that. Like they, you know, it's who just aren't vain in the same way. But the thinness obsession is always there, I think.
I was reading this morning that I didn't realize that the macrobiotic thing started quite as early as it did. There's this guy, Kevin Harrington, who's a real minor player in a sense in the Beatles story. But just to give you a sense of how minor you can be and then still make something of it. He wrote a book and he was the guy, if you watch the rooftop concert, there's a guy squatting down holding John's lyrics up for him. And it's that this is
the guy.
And he was an office boy at Brian Epstein's company and then went to work for Apple and became the assistant to the Beatles roadie Mal. But so he was talking in this book about White Album, Get Back kind of time, going out to a restaurant behind Paddington and bringing macrobiotic food for John at that point. But also, I found an inaccuracy in his book. He says that when he would make the Beatles sandwiches, mm-hmm. he'd have to add a thin layer of Marmite for Ringo.
Uh-huh.
Now, I played this Lady Madonna outtake yesterday, which has George talking about how they should do Marmite-flavoured crisps. And you can clearly hear Ringo say, but I don't like Marmite. What's going on there then?
What is going on there? He should think about that before he starts trying to make money off them and start writing books about them.
Well, I think a lot of people should think about that before they start trying to make money and write books about the Beatles. But
okay, listen. When you were talking about the German version of She Loves You,
mm-hmm.
and then you did an acting job of what it would be like, of what that conversation might have been like.
To Claire, come give me a deine hand for Jojo Rabbit.
Yes, and you did a little acting.
You're about to criticize my acting, aren't you?
It was so uncomfortable for me because of how bad your acting is.
Do you think it's uncomfortable for the listener?
No, probably it wasn't.
You think it is, but you're trying to spare my feelings.
No. I think you do a good job of getting like a nudge, wink, wink into your voice.
What I do really badly with, I think a lot of people do, is I don't like not knowing what I don't know. I like to be aware of my own limitations. And if I think I can do a passable job of something and I end up embarrassing myself, then that's a terrible feeling.
So that must have flared up anyway.
Do you think that's how Paul felt after Give My Regards to Broad Street?
No, what was Give My Regards to Broad Street?
It was his film that he released in the 80s.
Oh, and was it terrible?
It was very poorly reviewed. He roped Ringo into it and George Martin. And Ringo's wife and Linda were both in it as well. Barbara and Linda were both
but
in it.
George Martin was in it?
Yeah, but only, I mean, they're all kind of playing themselves, but it is a caper. It's about some tapes being stolen and Paul having to get these tapes back. And
these people, they don't know, they don't quit while they're ahead. Who's an artist of any kind who has quit while they were ahead?
Quit.
Seinfeld.
Yeah. But it's interesting. I think Paul has tried his hand at a lot of stuff. He's got his children's book, Hey Grand Dude, and there's a new one coming out.
No, no, oi, that sounds terrible. It's like, don't write a children's book unless you're going to be really good at it, which it sounds like he hasn't been.
I haven't read it. I don't know if it's good or bad. I haven't read anything bad about it. I haven't heard anyone say he's embarrassing himself. But the frog chorus was good.
No, but am I right in thinking that was at least 30-some years ago?
It was in the 80s, yeah.
I'm not convinced. What I'm saying is it's interesting to be kind of the greatest in the world at something and then be comfortable being so mediocre to poor at other things.
It's very easy to understand how somebody goes from being told they're the greatest in the world at something to feeling like they can do anything.
Yeah.
We know somebody who worked with an extremely famous film star and talked about speaking to him after a long day filming and pretty quickly realizing that this particular film star was so handsome and so famous that he'd forgotten that everything that came out of his mouth wasn't automatically interesting.
I have subsequently listened to quite a few interviews with that same very famous actor. And I think he's very charismatic.
Yes, but this is something I keep coming back to. You've got no idea what somebody is like from hearing them talk on an interview. You can get clues.
I disagree with you about that. Of course you can. You can go, oh, this person can make fun of themselves in this way and not in another, and they have got this level of self-awareness, or they don't.
I am telling you, I have first-hand knowledge of famous people who, if you see them being interviewed, seem like the most charming, charismatic, self-effacing people around, and then in real life, they can behave like monsters. Or be extremely surly or unpleasant.
Okay.
It's a skill that people have, knowing how to turn it on for a chat show.
I'm not saying, like, I think it's interesting that someone can do an interview and care about wanting to seem charismatic and interesting. And then, like, I care so much what someone thinks about me. That I then, well, I don't know, but then I'm not a big Hollywood star. Who knows what that does to you in terms of what you care about, what people think. Let's move on. Why do you think the Beatles gave permission for clearance on Jojo Rabbit when they're so protective of their songs and films otherwise?
I am genuinely interested to know how that process works. On that film, from the reading I did, the composer who did the score had worked with Paul, so was able to get in front of Paul and say, look, it's this guy, Taika Waititi. He's really
so
good. Yeah. But why they say yes, because they say yes to so little, how those decisions get made is really interesting.
Some of it must be quite arbitrary.
I wonder if it's fairly much always that there's a personal in from somebody. But I think they're all really... They've had to become, since they were very young, very good at saying no to favors from people who are friends. Because everybody wants something from them.
Do we know from any Germans how good they did or didn't sound singing in German?
Quite bad, I think.
Okay.
I think they deliberately sang Sie liebt dich. I think they made the Dick not sound like she loves you, but she loves Dick.
That's funny.
Well, that's the thing in Beatles records. Hunter Davis, who wrote the official biography, he talks about being around when they were writing With a Little Help from My Friends. And I've always loved that line, what do you see when you turn out the light? I can't tell you, but I know that it's mine. Because I think there's something strange about it and something like maybe even slightly profound about it. And then he writes in the official biography about being there when they're writing it. And I think they're all just sniggering because is he talking about his dick or not? And I was thinking about happiness as a warm gun yesterday. And when I feel your finger on my trigger, I'm sure it wasn't lost on John that happiness sounds like a penis. I'm convinced. I'm absolutely convinced. I think, and I know that wasn't the inspiration of it, but I'm sure, just knowing what we know about them, that would have been a sniggery thing. And you know that thing in Girl, where they're all singing tit in the background.
No, but that's, I mean, this is really up my alley.
Yeah,
I
know.
I'm really finding this funny.
But I think that's the thing about the Beatles. We look for, this stuff on a higher level sometimes, whilst forgetting they're these guys who put four of Fish and Finger Pie into a song because it's filthy.
Oh my God.
And then, as I said on the show the other week, I might have said it on Twitter, how weird is that being Paul McCartney in your 70s sitting next to Barack Obama, having that song performed at the White House by Elvis Costello, and hearing those words for a Fish and Finger Pie, which is just like a filthy Liverpool schoolboy expression. Like the journey from one thing to the other.
Yeah,
like how
so
do you take
wild.
That in? Yeah.
So offensive about women and vaginas and fish. That's all I'll say.
Yeah.
I think that'll stay in.
It will.
It's just so ridiculous. I mean, I'm not a lesbian, I don't know, but I just don't think it's right.
I don't think it's right either.
It's too gross of a conversation to even have, even for me.
That's weird. I don't think that's ever happened before.
No, but it makes me feel a little vomity.
Okay.
The F-bomb left. Why am I saying we're not on the radio now? I can say fuck. Why was that left in to Hey Jude? Did they just not notice it until later and like obsessive fans discovered it? Or was it like, ooh, it'll give it some flavor?
I think John heard it in the mix and then was excited that it was there and said, let's leave it in.
I like that.
One story I've read from one of the engineers. Nobody's exactly sure whether it's Paul or John. It's very difficult
yes,
to tell. And what happens, some people say it's Paul fluffed something on the piano. Some people say John fluffed a vocal line or whatever. So nobody quite knows what prompted and debate rages as to who it is. But I've definitely read that it was John who heard it and said we should leave that in.
Why do you think I'm so sweary?
Your family is sweary, or your mum is sweary. Your mum is sweary.
No, that's not right.
No, it is right.
Like my mom is.
I have heard your mum. I have heard your mum use language that I've never even heard my dad use. That's.
But don't you think it's only if she's in a rage and you actually don't see? Have you ever seen my mum in a rage?
I've seen your mum in a bit of a rage once, a couple of times actually. But I saw her once in a rage on your driveway.
Oh, yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah.
Your mom has like a real problem with strong language.
Not in The Sopranos,
she's watching The Sopranos and then she feels like it's just she says, a fair representation of how they live their
lives. That's just how they talk, Jeffrey, isn't it?
I don't understand it about myself and I'm really trying. I just don't understand where it comes from. And I think your thing about like, oh, my mom swears, it just doesn't, when I hear you say that, I don't go, oh, right, that's what it is. I don't think that's right.
Would your act be less funny if you took all the swear out of it, all the profanity out of it?
Probably a little bit, which doesn't reflect well on it, but that can be a lifelong project. But that's not what I'm even talking about. I'm talking about like in conversation, why do I have to do it so much?
But those words serve a purpose then, either as intensifiers when you're being emphatic or to make something funnier.
No, I'm not in control of it. I don't like it.
Okay.
When you were speaking to Chloe and Daisy.
Yes.
This is just a compliment for you.
Mm.
I feel really, really proud to be with someone who can have a long conversation with women in their very early 20s and not be gross and or condescending.
Thank you.
I think that's a guy who's almost 50 talking to women who are like, what are they? 22?
Yeah, 21? 23. They said early 20s.
It feels like inevitably, best case scenario, that would be about a guy condescending to them or educating them or anything. And I just thought it was so non-smarmy of you.
Thank you. I just think they've got a different perspective to what I have because I'm a middle-aged man and because I'm a man more than anything. If they're learning about the Beatles story and they're learning that they're seeing the way that Yoko or Linda or whoever were spoken about, written about, treated, that I've got some sense of it, but I just think, you know, if you're a young woman, and I think both of them are really kind of studied in feminism and feminist literature, they're going to just see stuff that I won't. So I found it so interesting, actually, to hear from them. And I really want them to go away and write a book, because most Beatles books that get written shouldn't be written because they're not adding anything. Whereas I feel that somebody writing about that topic could be shed light on the story in a different way. And there are characters in that story who I haven't thought enough about that I would love to know more about. And they could be the people to do it, or someone should.
Here's I'm a 41 year old woman. You're a 47 year old man. So we're old enough now that we can think about the youth in a disparaging way. Like I can be like, ugh, young. Ugh,
yeah.
See, there it is again. Yeah. Oh, these people. And the most extreme version of that happening to me is I was doing a comedy gig at the Jewish community center in West Hampstead. And I was doing this comedy gig and it was so difficult. It was like me having to interact with people on a screen. And it was really, really hard. And everyone else in the room seemed to understand, oh, this poor woman having to do this difficult comedy gig. And then about a third of the way into the gig, these young people rolled up late, which is disgusting. If you're someone who runs late consistently, you're a bad person. And if you're thinking like, Bill Clinton ran late, Obama ran late, you're not Obama and you're not Bill Clinton. You're just a late, you're just somebody who thinks, you're somebody who is comfortable with the idea of other people waiting for them. And that makes you on some level a bad person. It doesn't mean that you don't have redeeming gifts, but it means that there is a selfish darkness in you. So anyway, these girls, they were all young women, roll up late. They sit down right at the front, which is a disgusting move. If you come late, you sit at the back. So they sit down and I have to do some crowd work with them. What's going on, ladies? Why are you late? What's happening? They've been to dinner. Okay, fine. So I'm trying to go on with what I have to do. And then they start, like they're at the movies, they start taking out bags of stuff and eating it. And I'm like, what are you doing? I'm a person. I'm a person here trying to do my job. You come late. You're unpacking food. You're making so much noise. Like the narcissism, the lack of empathy involved in what they were doing. And they're like, and with no, like with real rage, one of them was like, you're shaming us and it's disgusting. I'm like, I'm not shaming you. You have terrible behavior. You have horrible manners. If I know that my son, when he's whatever you are, 22, thinks it's okay to show up late at something and then sit in front of someone and eat while they're doing their job, I will have done a bad job. That's what your parents did. A bad job with you. I didn't say that to them, but I was like, I'm not shaming you. You said you just came from dinner and now you're sat eating in front of me and making noise and it's obnoxious. So if I'm shaming you, it's not about your food behavior. It's about your general behavior. And then it was just bad between us. And then they made me, and it was awful. The point is.
But what would have felt better than if a bunch of people of that age, early 20s, had turned up at your gig and thought you were the best thing that they'd ever seen?
It would have been wonderful.
So why is the approval of a young person better than...
No. I will say, an approval of a young person does not... It makes me feel good. If I'm doing something that's about being in my 40s and I'm like, oh, this is still funny to someone who's 23, that makes me feel good.
Yeah.
But nothing makes me feel as good as if I get to do a gig with people that are mostly in my age group. Because they're more discerning. That's just what I think. I think the older you are, the more you know about the world. But what I want to say is, it's a very good Louis C.K. bit, RIP, forever in our hearts. It's basically about like the most educated 22-year-old does not know as much as a guy who dropped out of high school who's 52. He just knows more.
Yeah, but not about everything.
No, but generally, the more life you have, the more life experiences you have accumulated, the more wisdom you bring to
things. Here's what I think.
We have to wrap up.
No, I know.
But I just want to say...
But I think, you know, what you learn as you get older, in ways that I think are really admirable about being young as well and can play a big part in changing the world, things are much more black and white when you're younger.
Yes.
And the older you get, I think if you sort of grow older and grow wiser, everything gets a bit more grey, not just your hair. So I think that's what you're talking about in terms of a 52-year-old who's dropped out of school at 15 knows more than a highly educated 22-year-old. You see more of life and you think about human behavior differently. But
hopefully, but yeah. Maybe not every 50-year-old. But anyway, the point is that as angry and upset as those young women made me feel, Chloe and Daisy made me feel so inspired and happy.
Wait till you hear the full conversation. You'll never.
I might actually listen to that.
Really?
Yeah, because they really turned me on in that way, I thought. And they said some stuff that I sort of disagreed with a little bit, but I just, not disagreed with. I'm not a Yoko Ono fan. That's all I'll say. But, and I think she was on the receiving end of extreme racism. But this is my point.
And misogyny.
I think that she can be on the receiving end of extreme racism and misogyny, and I can still be like, but I don't like her or respect her art. But I would like to have my mind changed, and I think they might be the people to do it.
Well, here they are. Here is that conversation with Chloe and Daisy from the All About the Girl podcast.
Beetlejuice with Jeff Lloyd. Limitless, undying love for the band who did it all.
We're Chloe and Daisy, and we've just started a podcast called All About the Girl, about the women in the Beatles' lives and the Beatles story. We met online, desperate to find people who weren't bored to death by our endless Beatles conversations. I'm in Barnard Castle, and Daisy is...
I'm in Liverpool.
And you're both in your 20s.
Yeah, yes. We're both in our early 20s.
And which bits of online, not that I will go there because I know that just would be inherently creepy, but which bits of online are people in their early 20s going to share this love of the Beatles?
I've found Tumblr and Twitter mostly. I think Instagram sort of has a younger to mid-teen audience, but a lot of the people who stay with the Beatles sort of move on to Twitter or Tumblr as they sort of mature and grow out of the platform, I guess.
Something I've wondered about for a while is when I watch footage of the Beatles when they were together, you see a lot of young women as fans. And yet when I go online or when I search for a Beatles podcast, I can find a lot of stuff by people in my exact demographic, which I mean men of a certain age, but not as much from women, young women especially. What are your thoughts on how they've been co-opted by a certain type of chin-stroking man?
I think for me, and this is probably a bit controversial, I feel like the fandom has not really moved on in a very long time. And, you know, as you said, a lot of the podcasts, a lot of the writings are by men. They often airbrush the women out or don't do the women, give the women a fair shake, which is what we're trying to do with our podcast, but what we'd just love to see more of.
Yeah, definitely. I think before you sort of really get talking to these people, there is that feeling of them viewing female fans as very immature and silly and still like screaming Beatlemaniacs. And obviously there's nothing wrong with that, but it's the way they kind of see all female fans as very immature and silly and not smart enough to have these discussions, when actually I think Chloe and I and many of our friends could also, you know, we could have a very intellectual conversation about the music itself, but also at the same time, maybe we do want to scream over how much we love the Beatles, and it doesn't make us or our love for the Beatles any lesser than that.
I want to scream too, and I want to have the nerdy conversations, but it feels a bit like history has been rewritten, and I think a lot of people have this idea in their head that while the up until the point they stopped touring, they were a band that teenage girls screamed at. And then as soon as they started using the studio as an instrument, that's when the men got interested, and that's when the music became for hairy, bearded, mustachioed men. And that just isn't the case. It isn't the case that their records stopped being bought by young women and started being bought by men. I'm sure their kind of audience was made up of both throughout their recording career. So what happened? How did that change?
I'm not sure, but I think it's a phenomenon you see with a lot of pop culture. So for the Beatles, when they kind of became something for classic rock fans, male classic rock fans to love and kind of act superior about, you also see in a lot of sci-fi fandoms. So for instance, Star Trek, when it first came out, it was quite demonized for being like for housewives and just a silly women thing. But then at some point, and I guess it's a bit of a mystery, it crossed over to a thing for serious nerdy guys, and women aren't allowed unless you answer these 50 million questions.
I think it's about the writings too, you know, the biographies, the journalism around them. When all the serious writing on them is written by men, then it's going to become the idea that men rule the roost in that serious discussion and women don't.
I think a lot of women and younger girls come into it and go, oh, I can't, I want to do this, but I can't because it's not the space for me, because it's already either such a heavily written on topic that there's nothing else to write, or this is such a male-dominated space that I don't feel like I'm going to be taken seriously.
The idea for the podcast is the Women in the Beatles story. Now, are you talking about the women they were romantically involved with, or are you going broader than that? Is it women who influenced who they were and what they became in some way?
It's more the latter. So I think for me, it started with Yoko Ono, right? I'm a huge Yoko Ono fan. I own all her records. I love her so much. And you know, and I was sick of going on YouTube and watching videos of her and seeing comments that were just disgraceful, you know, that she was payback for Hiroshima, that this is the wife you get when you do too many drugs. These are the highest rated comments, you know. And people say to me all the time, why are you defending her so much? Why do you care? When she stops being a cipher for the way that men talk about all creative or unconventional women, then I'll stop caring. But right now, while Yoko remains an insult or a verb about what you can do to a man or do to a creative project, I'll carry on screaming about it. So it started on that, and then I started reading more deeply about the women. And yeah, we are going to do podcasts on Julia and Mimi and things like that, so women who were important. But reading on all these women, their importance is just thrown away. They're made into these like one-note caricatures where Mimi is stern and Julia is crazy and Yoko is evil and Cynthia is sweet. And, you know, when we talk for hours and hours and hours about these men and their, you know, what's going on internally and their tragic backstories, and then the women are all like stick figures around them, it drove us mad, I think. And we wanted this podcast, we wanted to listen to it, and we couldn't find it, so we were like, right, let's try and make it.
Have you got any thoughts on why the Beatle marriages that worked were to people who weren't from the United Kingdom?
That's really interesting, and I've never actually thought about it before, but I think it might possibly be that level of separation.
I think for me it allows them an element of escape, like you were saying. I think specifically to do with class. I think it allows them to move class in a way that British people would see through, and I think we still see through with regards to John. I think, you know, John does the whole working class hero bit, and Yoko really lent into that and was like, yes, but Yoko's an aristocrat, you know, of course John seemed working class to her, she was blue-blooded. But, you know, we know that Mendip just had a servant's bell that Mimi refused
to take down. It's funny. I mean, I do think it's like we're all northern, and I think we can see Mendips and we can understand that John was the middle class one really easily, or at least was brought up at Mimi's house in that way. I think a lot of southern middle class people can't, you know, they just see Liverpool as this kind of, I don't know, probably a stereotype of a grim northern city. But it's funny, in the Beatles even, the amount of little jibes, and you even hear it, I think, when it's the three of them together in the anthology interviews, about John's poshness, you know, John being given £100 for his birthday, John going to college being mentioned on the Christmas records, or maybe some of the BBC interviews by Ringo. He was seen as posher by the other Beatles in a way that a lot of people can't read.
Yeah, I mean, we're northern, so we go, look, he lived in a house that had the house had a name, and the name was on the gate. You know, that's the ultimate level of poshness, isn't it? And I think, you know, we discuss this often. I think actually those first 5 years with Julia, not that level of poshness at all. Yeah. We know that. So he was absolutely forged in the fire of that. But growing up, we're definitely moving towards middle class in terms of that. But again, we often say that even now we think it's very difficult to explain that to Americans, you know.
I think it's even difficult to explain it to Southerners.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, on the marrying Americans thing, I think, you know, it just allows them an element of reinvention. Mm. That they can, now's the time. And I think they all did this, but John did it especially, like retelling his life story in whatever way suited him. You know, he was a genius at school, or he was an idiot at school, depending on what interview he's giving. Mm. And I think, you know, if you're with someone from a different country who didn't know you during that time, it's a real opportunity to sort of play with the truth, especially if you're sick of yourself.
Yeah. That social climbing is such an interesting... Because I think Paul is sometimes thought of as being the social climber in the group, in that when they come to London, that life that Jane's family have is instantly very attractive to him, and he wants to soak it up. But Linda was from this rich New York family.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's always fascinated me since I got into the Beatles is the fact that Paul and Linda sent their kids to state school, not private school, nothing like that, just a regular state school. It's quite humble in a way, that they saw their kids as equal to everyone else. They didn't see themselves as better than someone else just because they had loads of money.
That is something in him that must have been in Linda as well, that understood the value of at least trying to keep your feet on the ground in some way, I think.
And I think there's a real purity over what he's trying to do. It reminds me of, you know, if you were going to put that mentality as a record, it would be like the first McCartney album or Ram. Do you know what I mean? It's like trying to get back to the sort of purest simplicity that you can, and, you know, finding something really beautiful in that. And you're right, I think he understands that if you make yourself like the king of some kind of empire, then that means you actually have to do things, you know. I mean, you read about it a lot with Yoko, like all the staff she had to dismiss, the staff who stole things. The thing is, when you've got this like massive sprawling empire, which they sort of did, you know, with cows and an island and all sorts, you end up with loads of people working for you who, you know, you give them the opportunity to nick from you and betray you, and you end up in this like crazy Game of Thrones heightened world.
God, it must have been weird for her. So she grew up in this, as you say, aristocratic world where there were servants and there's a clear hierarchy. Those people aren't your friends. You know, they're people who might run your bath for you or bring your food or whatever. But there's quite a rigid class system in place, whereas the modern, you know, world of rock stars and entourages, there's a real blurring. And you see it with the Beatles and the amount of friends and acquaintances they employed and were enthralled with. There's a real blurring in how the people who work for you are also the people who you're socializing with and, you know, to some extent acolytes for you. And that must have been really weird, a really weird adjustment for her.
Well, she tells this story about when she was a little girl. She didn't have any friends and she didn't have siblings who were close enough in age, and she really wanted a friend. She asked her mum if she could have a friend, and the mum told the servant's daughter that she must be friends with Yoko, that she must play with her. And the servant's daughter is a few years older and she plays with her a lot. And, you know, Yoko says that she had no idea about this. She just thought this girl was like a best friend who was gifted to her like a dolly. But this girl, you know, she didn't want to play with a little girl. She had other things to do. And she says that one day she said, oh, my mother needs me, I need to go home. And Yoko followed her back to her house and saw her playing with her real friends. And she said, you know, it was this like devastating, like crushing moment that, you know, even her friend wasn't a real friend and things like that. And she writes in an essay about, you know, every time she reached for her mother, she got her fur coat or her manicure, and she used to have to stand in front of her father's desk and things. So actually, I don't think she was very well versed in having friends. Mm. And I think a lot of the sort of criticism you see of her is that she did treat the people in the Beatles entourage like servants, because she had no concept of them being allowed to be your friends. She'd been told for a long time that they were absolutely not your friends, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, it gives you a much more sympathetic lens to look at some of that behaviour through. So the first episode is on Yoko, specifically the album Approximately Infinite Universe. So you both, though, and I was surprised to hear this, you both make what I feel is a bold claim, which is that this Yoko album from 1973 is as good as any solo Beatle album.
Even I, when I first started listening to her music, all I'd heard my whole life was like a cat being put through a mangle. You know, and it was a disgrace. So when I sit down and listen to this album, and it's incredible. It was this like revelatory moment. Was like, I'm never going to listen to Men's Lies again, kind of thing. But it's just this fascinating thing, and especially just a very emotional insight into someone, I think, who is, we wrongly go, well, actually, she didn't smile and she had her hair over her face. And, you know, I think she was probably plotting something evil. And I don't like the fact that she screamed with Chuck Berry. And also she wore big sunglasses.
I think there's something interesting in what you just said in terms of her likability. You know, obviously you have studied her, you know her life extremely well, and you can apply that very sympathetic lens to her. I think there are other presentations which cast her in a less likable light. But whether or not that is true, like, the more interesting question is why should she be a certain type of likable? I'm not sure George Harrison or John Lennon or any of them really were always the most likable. Now, of course, they became immensely famous with that kind of lovable mop-top press conference, likability, good-natured, aren't they, like the lads from down the street. But they're a complicated people. And what do you make of the fact that we are so more willing to overlook that complexity in those four men than we are in Yoko, where so many of us, you think of her as some kind of punchline, or look at what was difficult about her, and you know, there's a lot of eye rolling about it.
I think on a lesser level, you just reminded me that you kind of see it with Jane and Linda too. Obviously, Linda knew that not everyone liked her because she did her own thing and she didn't conform to a lot of like patriarchal standards, which is where I think a lot of it comes down to. Even with female fans, we're still victims of patriarchal thought. And Jane, obviously, she's the one that broke up her and Paul's relationship, so people kind of demonize her for that. But with Yoko, she was so just herself throughout it all, and people didn't like that. They didn't like how she wasn't sort of palatable, how she wasn't sort of like easily compactable into this one space of what a woman should be or shouldn't be. You know, you can get into so much feminist theory about it. But by saying, oh, I don't like her because of this, because she doesn't conform to these, you know, likable standards, it is just perpetuating a lot of misogyny and patriarchal thoughts on what women should be.
The background and the era that the Beatles came from, a certain type of chauvinism was very much the norm. How good were they at breaking free of that?
I think it comes down to each Beatle. Obviously, Paul wanted Jane and Linda to stop their careers and just be, you know, his wife and the mother of his children, nothing else. And I think, you know, they all probably wanted that for their wives. George did. I know for sure he wanted Patty to quit her career as a model. And obviously, it is very telling of the time. I don't think it's fair to be like, oh, in the early years, they were all such feminists. Because they weren't. And I think I can speak for Paul, because I know this a bit quite well, that it was Linda who forced him to change his ways. Like, he didn't do it naturally. It was, you know, the anecdote that Linda said about how Paul just used to leave his clothes, you know, in a pile on the floor and she wouldn't pick it up because he had to learn. So it wasn't out of her being nice. It was out of her being like, no, I'm not going to be pushed around by you. And I think all of them probably had to go through that at some stage.
I think you're absolutely right about McCartney. And I think he probably did a slightly better job than Lennon. And Lennon cashes in on becoming this great feminist in 1972. But, you know, it was almost like it was a fad that he sort of lost interest in. And it was very much tied to his respect for Yoko. But when they separated, he said himself that the feminist part of him died. And, you know, some of his behaviour on the last weekend is, let's say, not very feminist. And I think we talk about this in the pod a bit, but it's not true feminism if your feminist is inextricably linked to your wife. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. But again, I don't want to hold them to anachronistic standards where I expect them to have, like, a level of feminism in 1962
yeah.
that would be like revelatory, you know?
But that raises an interesting point in itself, doesn't it? Because I feel like a lot of people in your generation can't get past the fact that John Lennon was violence. We know for a fact from Cynthia and from him at least once, and probably more than that, very probably. And yeah, you know, I don't think that can be excused. I think it's something you have to look at and talk about as a fan. I sort of come to this point with you can contextualize it in his background, and then you can look at the fact that we know about it because he spoke about it, and he spoke about it and attempted to deal with it in his art. And then you do see this progression towards feminism and change in the 70s, but it's making me quite uncomfortable now that you're sitting there and saying, yeah, but it you know, it wasn't real though, and it didn't last.
Well, he, you know, May Pang in her book claims that he assaulted her a few times as well. You know, that he choked her and that he threw her against a wall and things like that. So we had this discussion. We have it all the time because, you know, obviously we're both passionate campaigners against DV. We think it's really important. Mm-hmm. And but for us, yes, you have to contextualize it and you have to compartmentalize it in your own head. But we can't deny it. It's something that happened. It was horrendous and it's completely unacceptable. And I think as long as we put that as a disclaimer before we start enjoying his art as fans, it, you know, and we have a lot of affection for him, you know, we're a sucker for Turn Left at Greenland and all that. We do think it's very funny and we, you know, we liked him even as children. But I think absolutely, like from a feminist standpoint, we can't shy away from that. But there's a difference between confronting it and sort of cancelling him and binning the whole thing. Where yeah. you go, I can't listen to the Beatles because John Lennon did this one thing. And it's like, no, I think we need to have the conversation. I think we need yeah. to say, this behaviour is absolutely wrong. If a man tries the behaviour on you now, run or call for help or something. But equally, you know, we do have empathy for John as a human being. And we just wish that that empathy would also be extended to his wives and girlfriends too, you know. We have an understanding, but it's also not our place to forgive him. Absolutely. It's not our place to go, it was okay because he got better in the late 70s, which I see a lot. And it makes me uncomfortable because actually, you know, that's a very parasocial relationship we're taking on there and it's not our role. But I think as long as we confront it and say, you know, this is abusive behaviour and it's horrific, I think we can continue being, you know, fans of the music and of the art and of the bed-ins and the events and things. But for me, I think it's an interesting conversation thing that you have to have with people. And I wish that fandom was more open about it because I do worry about teenage girls getting in and seeing things like, well, it didn't matter because X, or he got over it, so... And it's like, you know, we've got to make it very clear that actually, if a man apologises to you after he's banged your head off a pipe, you don't have to take him back. But I think, you know, we can have nuanced adult conversations about all that was good and all that was bad that we know of about John Lennon.
Not on Twitter, you can't.
No, exactly. Or on Tumblr.
But I think your point about anachronistic points and stuff and about our view as younger fans is really interesting. And it's something Chloe and I have talked about before, that our place as northern female young fans is so interesting, especially when we're interacting with other people from our age who are American. For example, they don't get this sort of northern male attitude that's so perpetuated still in society today. And it's something that, yeah, there's a lot of men who do stray from it and are feminists and are really wonderful. But it's so, if you do stray from it, you're kind of shamed by a lot of society still in the North, where I've spent all of my life pretty much until now. I saw it a lot, and a lot of people who would otherwise be really nice, they were punished by other men, by, you know, society, even other women, from straying from this, you know, northern male stereotype. And I'm like, when you get this whole cancel culture sort of like debate around him, but they don't understand the context around it and how men are raised and how, you know, being different is seen in a lot of society up here.
Just before we get into the last bit, I wondered if you had any thoughts on the trope of women as muses, because that suddenly feels very outdated. The woman sitting, the sunlight is coming in through the window, she's sitting there looking beautiful while the genius gazes upon her and sees inspiration.
Yeah, I think women as muses had such a huge part of the Beatles, you know, the early songs, their later songs, their solo work. There was always a woman as a muse somewhere in there. And it comes down to, how is that woman treated, you know? When you completely romanticise a woman to the point of putting her in a song as your muse or any art piece, you kind of create an abstract form of that woman where she's not a woman for all she is, if that makes sense. She's not a person anymore. She is something in this art, and that's all the way you can view her.
Is Patty the woman who most conforms to the traditional idea of a muse? Is she the one in the Beatles story?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Patti's very much, when I think about muses in the Beatles music, I think of something, you know, and Patti.
And part of that is the video they made, you know, with the wives and stuff.
What I find interesting is that, you know, Yoko and Linda are very much muses, but the fact that Maybe I'm Amazed is written about a makeupless woman refusing to do his laundry, and, you know, and Oh Yoko is written about a woman who keeps getting up on stage and screaming like a cat, or keeps going, let's get our kit off and take another photo, you know, and that kind of thing. The fact that these are really unconventional women who start being used as muses, I find that really interesting use of the trope, I suppose, that, you know, and I think that's what annoyed people, that suddenly the muses were no longer like conventionally very beautiful, very quiet women, and were like women who were sort of messy and all over the place and did their own thing, and then the men are still writing adoring songs about them.
I've asked you to pick a song. Have you been bullied into this, Daisy, or was it completely collaborative with Chloe?
No, it was completely collaborative. She rang me and was like, we need to pick a song, do you have any ideas? And we were kind of like, we should probably do about Yoko, because this is what the episode's on, this is, you know, an introduction to our podcast.
So you've chosen Dear Yoko. What can you tell us about this, Chloe?
In true Double Fantasy style, it's very romantic on the surface, but then it has this almost desperation to it. I just think it's a more interesting song than it's often given credit for.
Well, I'll play that song in a second. Before I do so, I'm just going to rattle through some quick Beatles questions with you. Would you rather have your portrait painted by Stuart Sutcliffe or have it taken by Astrid Kircher?
Painted by Stu.
Taken by Astrid.
Revolution or Hey Jude?
Revolution.
Hey Jude.
What's more impressive, the feedback at the beginning of I Feel Fine or the backwards vocals in Rain?
Backwards vocals in Rain.
The feedback in I Feel Fine.
Would you rather have worked at Applecore HQ at Savile Row or at Abbey Road Studios?
Abbey Road.
Abbey Road.
If you were allowed access to Abbey Road and you could open up that vault and listen to any of the Beatles' multi-track tapes, what would you like to hear?
I'd like to hear more about the recording of Because, I think. I love that song, and I think it's beautiful. And I know Yoko was heavily involved in inspiring it.
I just like to hear the early tapes, the early excitement of being new in the studio and this big break.
Was Magic Alex a goodie or a baddie?
Baddie.
Baddie.
If you could have been a guest at any of the Beatles' weddings, whose would it have been?
I wanted to be at the bedding.
Paul and Linda's.
No, we know there's no such thing, but who is your nomination for Fifth Beatle?
Yoko Ono.
Brian Epstein.
All right, so I'm going to play Dear Yoko. Before I do, and before you're drowned out by the Day in the Life Orchestra, tell me why this band? Why are you, two people in their 20s, talking about this band in 2021?
Because I don't think that there has been a band since that encapsulates all of human emotion and human experience in the way the Beatles do. And there's something about the time and the personalities that you can just get lost in, and it becomes your happy place.
Yeah, they make me incredibly happy, and I've met so many wonderful friends through them, and there's always something else to explore, which is why I'm so attached to them.